Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a look at the arguments in favor of and against Prop 138, which deals with tipped workers.
And as Route 66 approaches its centennial, pieces of it are being lost.
But first, the Arizona Republican Party announced this week it will not have an election night party. It's a break from tradition and is raising a lot of eyebrows in the political world this week as questions swirl about why. The state GOP has been in dire financial straits for some time after its former chair was accused of lavish spending in recent years past, including on a 2022 election night party that racked up hundreds of thousands of dollars in expenses. So is this decision about money or something more? KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez is here from our politics desk to tell us more. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so the first thing a lot of folks assumed when this was announced was that it was about money, right? That the state GOP didn't have the money to do it. You spoke with the current chair of the party, mm-hmm. Gina Swoboda. What did she have to say?
She said that's stupid, and that is a quote. She said that she would rather spend money practically on the campaigns, and this is not an indication of them, you know, not having enough cash, but that they actually want to spend it on things like door knocking and making sure that they win the elections. She said that they're going to celebrate at the inauguration. That'll be the party.
But you also looked at the actual numbers and whether or not there is cash. What did it say?
There's not that much cash. Their most recent campaign finance shows that they have about $340,000 cash on hand. And as opposed to the Democratic Party, the Democrats had about 5.1 million.
Wow. Okay. So a big discrepancy there. Is that common?
Common is difficult to say with elections, but not exactly. I mean, the Democrats do have a lot coming in from out of state. They've been spending really, really aggressively and heavily for years now. Mm-hmm. The Republican Party has had some shakeups in leadership. And you know, the response to that from the donors has gone a few different ways. We saw back in the last election cycle that sometimes people would donate directly to the candidates or directly to local parties, like the county party, for example, rather than the state GOP, potentially because of the issues in how the money was being spent. But that was a different chair, a different time. Fundraising tactics have changed. We've had several different AZ GOP chairs over the last few years. We went from, I believe, Graham to Lines to Ward to DeWitt to Swoboda. Mm. So, yeah.
A lot. Yeah. And you spoke with one of those other former state GOP chairs who said that he thinks Swoboda made the right call here.
Yes, he did. He did. He said that it makes sense to be practical and it makes sense to focus on the campaigning and that it's irresponsible to spend, you know, all of your cash on an election night party, especially if you could have used that cash to win the elections that you're trying to celebrate.
And this was former Chair Robert Graham, we should say. So the state GOP has also been in the spotlight because of divisions within the party, right, Cameron? Like, since the rise of former President Donald Trump, we've seen a major split in the local party, with some becoming real Trump hardliners, others pushing for a more traditional kind of centrist GOP message. Is that playing a role here?
I don't know that it played a role in the decision to not have a party, but Graham and I did talk a little bit about that, and he acknowledged that it's real, and also that people he thinks are more bitter now about when they've lost their elections and coming to celebrate with the rest of the party and, you know, be there all for one and one for all and maybe have some bad blood, and also, of course, with the Democrats, whereas in the old days, and I mean the really old days, he says, you know, they would have their parties right next to each other, essentially, the Republicans and the Democrats, and people would kind of tolerated, and the Republicans were not so divided and not so bitter about maybe what happened in the primaries.
Interesting. Okay. So there's also the question about what we will actually know on election night, right? I spoke with pollster Paul Bentz on the show earlier this week. He said it's likely that Democrats could be ahead on election night because of who votes early, essentially. Do you think these kind of voting patterns are also playing into what might happen on election night and why there might not be a party?
Yes, Swoboda mentioned that as well. She was like, you know, on election night, we're not going to have necessarily race calls, so we could just be standing around looking at some results coming in, but not have anything to actually celebrate yet. So it doesn't make sense because it takes so many days to process the ballots. And in Arizona, you know, there could also be recounts, et cetera. Yeah. So it takes time.
Is there any concern here or speculation here, Cameron, that people are just thinking, you know, the GOP's worried they're not going to do so well here?
I don't think that anyone would say that out loud. I think that the Republicans are, you know, burrowing down and really putting their focus on the campaigns. And
right.
that's going to make the difference in their hopes.
And based on polling, they probably will do well here on some of these races, big ones as well.
Yes, I can't imagine they're going to lose everything.
Yeah. Let's talk about the actual value in having an election night party, Cameron. You've been covering politics here for some time. Gina Swoboda talked about this as well. Robert Graham talked about this as well. Is there any value, you think?
Well, I'm a little sad because I was planning to go. yeah, there's value in having a party in the terms of like morale and bringing the community together and sort of saying thank you to all the people who worked on these campaigns and just, you know, showing solidarity with one another as the results come in. But is it as important as winning the campaigns? I suppose not.
I suppose not. All right. We'll leave it there for now. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez joining us from our politics desk with the latest. Cameron, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Among the many ballot measures Arizona voters are deciding this year is Proposition 138, which the state legislature referred to the ballot. It's called the Tipped Workers Protection Act, although critics have argued that title is misleading. Under current law, restaurants are allowed to pay their tipped employees up to $3 per hour less than the minimum wage, as long as their tips bring that total up to the minimum wage. Prop 138 would keep what's known as the tip credit in place, but it would amend the state constitution to allow restaurants to pay tipped employees up to 25% per hour less than the minimum wage, as long as those workers earn at least the minimum wage plus $2 an hour. Supporters argue it'll help workers by ensuring they earn above minimum wage and that it'll help restaurants keep their costs under control. Critics, meanwhile, say it'll hurt workers by paying them an even lower salary and worry those employees will have to rely more on tips than they do now. We have two perspectives on this today, Steve Chukri, president and CEO of the Arizona Restaurant Association, and Geraldine Miranda, economic policy analyst with the Arizona Center for Economic Progress at Children's Action Alliance. And Steve, let me start with you. Why do you think this is a good idea?
Well, it obviously was fostered by us and our industry, and it was actually a direct response to the One Fair Wage, which is a group that came in from outside of Arizona trying to take away our tip credit, right, to change the current construct of how our tipping structure works here in Arizona. They've targeted Arizona, Ohio, and Massachusetts. And so this is a direct response to that. Our tipped workers, 90% of which, by the way, support our tipping structure, support how they run restaurants and how they operate. And to upend that would create a fiscal disaster for restaurants. So what Prop 138 does is it preserves the tipping credit structure that we have here in Arizona. And it also guarantees $2 more than the minimum wage with tips for all of our tipped employees.
Is this still necessary given that the One Fair Wage withdrew their signatures and will not be on the ballot?
It is, because they're going to keep coming back. In fact, they've said they are going to come back and go city by city starting in 2025 to take away the tip credit. We wanted to be on offense this time and say, no, not in Arizona. We want to preserve our tipping structure. As well as our employees and our restaurateurs.
All right. So, Geraldine, why do you think that Prop 138 is not a good idea?
So we advocate for children and families. And so in looking at this proposition, we think that this will be harmful to children and families, in particular women. Right. So women make up 70% of tipped workers in Arizona. And, you know, tipped workers do not make a living wage right now. And this will just make it even harder for workers to meet their, you know, the rising costs of living.
What concerns do you have about tip workers earning less money if Prop 138 were to pass than they do now?
So, you know, housing is through the roof, right? You know, census data just came out showing that, you know, 54% of Arizonans are paying more than 30% of their income in housing, which means that they're cost burden. This is higher than the 47% in 2019. And this proposition will essentially lower the wages for workers.
Steve, there have been a number of workers who work for tips who have stated publicly that they're concerned about potentially earning less money were this to pass, and are nervous about, you know, as Geraldine referenced, being able to pay their bills and things like that. Can you assure workers that they will not earn less money if this initiative passes?
Well, first and foremost, I think it's important to preface by saying I think the work that Geraldine does and the organization she represents, they are trying to help families. And it's not a disagreement about their scope of work, because I applaud the gesture and what they try to do for families. And I think that's a very good thing. I think where we disagree is how we get there. And to Geraldine's point that, you know, it is a tough right now with rising costs. We see inflation and all across Arizona. We see it all across the country. And that all being said, though, I think when you look at the restaurant industry, we are a multi-billion dollar industry here in Arizona, but there's a lot of multi-billion dollars worth of costs that come with it. So all that being said, we believe we're the industry of opportunity. 70%, I don't know if I've heard that. I haven't heard that number. I don't believe that's accurate of 70% of all our servers are females. That sounds awfully high. But I will tell you that restaurant servers in the state of Arizona are making well above $30 an hour with tips. So, and on the national basis, it's $27 an hour with tips. So you've got the industry of opportunity in the restaurant business.
Is there a concern, though, that there could be some workers who will take home less pay if
Prop
138
passes? Because we're guaranteeing $2 more than the minimum wage with tips. That's more than they're making now. So, no, we don't see that. And you have to also imagine that, you know, restaurant menu prices go up, tips go up. The counter is the concern. 87% of tipped workers across the country are concerned that if you remove the tip credit, as has been done in other communities, that tips will go down because surcharges will be added to tickets. That's more of a threat to the servers than what we're proposing here today.
Geraldine, does the fact that, as Steve said, there's sort of that almost kind of like a hold harmless provision where workers will get that extra, you know, that extra $2, does that sort of alleviate any of the concerns that you have?
It doesn't. It does not guarantee that workers will make more money. There is no evidence of that. What it does guarantee is that, you know, workers will get less wages. So, right, if they make the $2 above, right, employers will be allowed to pay them 25% less than the minimum wage. Right now, they're paying them 21% less than minimum wage. So, this will allow them to pay them more. And, you know, how do you calculate, you know, right, this who's making $2? How do you know when someone's making $2? This doesn't repeal what's currently in statute. So it's essentially adding like a third wage system. So essentially, you know, it would be on workers to, you know, determine, like, did I make $2 above minimum wage this week or did I not, right? If I did this week and, you know, my wage was slightly lowered, right? You know, if I don't next week, you know, how do I go to my employer and say, you know, I didn't make $2 above, you know, are you going to pay me more? Like it has all these it's really complicated. It makes it just very difficult and, you know, opens opportunities for potential violations.
I think it's important to note that we're not creating anything new here. This tip credit already exists. It's existed for decades. It's always existed in Arizona. And so there are protocols. If you're not making the minimum wage now, you're somehow not going to make the minimum wage when Prop 138 pass. And so that's why we have the Industrial Commission. That's why we have federal agencies that govern all of that. And so if a restaurateur is not paying their servers the minimum wage with tips, they can get into serious trouble with that. And so I don't want to suggest that this is a whole new way of doing things. No, we're simply modifying the current construct. There are, by legal authority, according to the legislature, according to the lawyers that have been hired to look at this, there are teeth in this. You can't simply get away scot-free without paying your employees.
Geraldine, do you agree that there is enough of an enforcement provision in this to make sure that workers are treated fairly?
I don't. It's just really hard to enforce. It's almost impossible. You know, USDOL did a
sweep. Department of Labor.
Yeah, the Department of Labor. Sorry, the Department of Labor did a federal sweep from 2010 to 2012, where they looked at, you know, 9,000 restaurants, and they found that there was an 84% violation. If you look at, you know, data from 2012 to 2019 of violations, that's at 85%. It's really difficult. I mean, even for, like, you know, employers who are well intentioned, it's just hard to keep track of this. And it gives, like, you know, it puts everyone in a very difficult situation.
Geraldine Miranda is economic policy analyst with the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. Steve Chukri is president and CEO of the Arizona Restaurant Association. We'll have more of our conversation in just a moment.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. And now back to our conversation about Prop 138, called the Tipped Workers Protection Act. To discuss the pros and cons of the ballot measure, I'm joined by Steve Chukri, President and CEO of the Arizona Restaurant Association, and Geraldine Miranda, Economic Policy Analyst with the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. And Steve, who exactly would be covered by this measure?
So it's going to be any tipped worker. Primarily, we've got four segments of the industry. We've got the quick service industry. You've got the fast casual, which would be like a Panera Bread.
A counter service kind of thing.
Yeah. And then you've got casual, which is your mainstream restaurants you would see in Olive Garden, the like. And then fine dining, right? Steakhouse, and higher upper end, white tablecloth restaurants. So primarily casual and fine dining is where this impacts, which is a bulk of the industry, right? There's a lot of quick service as well. But we're not pioneering here, and I think that's an important note to make, is that maybe back in the 80s, yes, it was more difficult to track these things, but not with point-of-sale service machines and everything else. 98% of all transactions happen with credit card. It's very simple. If someone wants to tip pool with the hostess but not at the back of the house, they can do that. It's all up to the restaurant. But through technology and how we pay our employees on debit cards and everything else today, it's very streamlined and it's very straightforward. So restaurateurs know what they're doing. Arizona restaurants are growing across the state. Our daily payroll right now is $21 million without tips. So we are a huge economic engine and economic driver for employment in the state of Arizona. And if all that was awry and was going so badly, we would be suffering, and we're not.
Geraldine, I want to ask you a little bit about what some have called tipping fatigue, which is that a lot of places now, over the last few years, you are asked for a tip in places that you weren't necessarily asked for it before. Now, most restaurants have traditionally given the option for a tip. But I'm wondering if, given inflation, given, as you say, things are more expensive now than they used to be, is there reason to believe that people are tipping less? And might that potentially impact the people who are relying on those tips now and might rely on them, continue to rely on them, should this pass?
I think so. There certainly seems to be tip fatigue, where you're being asked to tip everywhere that you go. And so, you know, with this proposition, you know, what guarantees that you're going to, that customers are going to pay more tips, right? But you are guaranteeing that workers are going to get lower wages. So, like, you know, how do, and especially with the tip fatigue, right? How do you know people are going to pay more in tips? They're not. It's even, you know, that actually helps the argument that, you know, you're going to get less tips. And at the same time, your wages are going to be cut, right? So, and your wages that are stable wages. So you're going to have to work more for unstable wages.
Steve, I guess the opposite question goes to you then, in terms of, if, let's say, people do tip less, or not, maybe not even universally, just at a particular meal or on a particular day at a particular place. What does that mean for the restaurants who would then, if this passes, have to make that up to their
workers?
They
do. They won't be able to take the tip credit. So you know, there isn't tipping. This isn't going to cause tipping to go down. Again, we're guaranteeing $2 more an hour with tips. If the restaurant isn't making that, meaning the server's not making that, then the restaurateur can't take the tip credit. He's got to make sure that employee's making the minimum wage. And so where we might actually agree is there is a truth about the tipping fatigue. And, you know, you go to Sky Harbor Airport, you pull a water out of the freezer or out of the refrigerator, and you put it down, and they skip it around to ask for a tip. We believe that tips are not an entitlement in the restaurant industry. We believe that tips are something to be earned.
Steve, we know that over the past couple of years, restaurants, some of them anyway, were kind of struggling to fill their staff, right? They didn't have enough workers for a number of reasons, it seems like. Where is that standing now?
We're back up to capacity. We're one of a handful of states that is. Nationally, we still haven't recovered 100%. But in Arizona, we have. And so we aren't putting a gun to anyone's head to come work in the restaurant industry. They want to come and work in the restaurant industry. And we've seen that as one of the fastest recovering states in the nation when it comes to laboring back up post-COVID.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Steve Chukri is President and CEO of the Arizona Restaurant Association. Geraldine Miranda, Economic Policy Analyst with the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. Thanks to you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger.
Well, if you ever It was nearly 100 years ago that the first cross-country road was built in America.
That's right. The idea was to have a way to move people and goods a long way. And the result was a road we all know very well today.
So in 1926, they commissioned Route 66, which, unlike today's interstates, was actually composed of a lot of existing roads and then some pieces that might have been paved and put together, a few bridges that were purpose-built for this, but really kind of strung together a way to make it easier for folks to get all the way from Chicago out to L.A.
Chicago to L.A. The song's already in your head, right, Mark?
I will not be forgetting Winona for the rest of the day, I promise.
That was Amy Webb, who leads the Preserve Route 66 initiative for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And she was talking to me about the upcoming centennial of the Mother Road in 2026. Preparations are already underway to get it ready for its close-up. And they'll be necessary because, as Webb told me, we're losing pieces of that history all the time.
Back in between the 70s and the 80s, Route 66 was piece by piece being replaced by the interstate.
Right.
And, of course, when that happened, a lot of the businesses that had been on Route 66, that kind of business, that traffic moved up to the interstate. And so you had communities that had seen thousands of cars come through on a daily basis that suddenly it was like a ghost town. Mm. You know, it's commemorated even in movies. The Disney Pixar feature Cars has a whole section where they talk about just how the road used to wind through the landscape. And, you know, today these communities don't have that.
40 years ago, that interstate down there didn't exist.
Really?
Yeah. Back then, cars came across the country a whole different way.
How do you mean?
Well, the road didn't cut through the land like that interstate. It moved with the land, you know? It rose, it fell, it curved. Cars didn't drive on it to make great time. They drove on it to have a great time.
You know, I think Arizona actually was a real early leader in recognizing the historic value and the nostalgia associated with Route 66. But an effort that started to create organizations dedicated to historic Route 66 to help bring economic development back to these communities and to create historic designations for Route 66 as well.
Yeah. So lots of efforts to preserve it, which we'll talk about more in a moment. I want to talk a little bit about the ways in which this has become such an icon and like why you think that is. Like you mentioned, you know, the Disney movie Cars, like we know so well, but this goes back way further in history than that, just in terms of the iconography, the Americana aspect of Route 66.
Oh, absolutely. It is. I don't know of any other resource that has been immortalized in literature, in songs, in movies. I mean, everything from John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath that talks about the Western migration. And then, of course, you know, songs, lots of songs. So it's something that just about every American has heard of Route 66 and has some idea of what they think it is. It has its own mystique.
Yeah, it does seem to kind of cut through and across boundaries, across our culture. So we've got the centennial here coming up. You mentioned 1926, right? Now we're coming up on 2026, and this will be a big deal. But it sounds like your organization, many others, are working really hard to sort of prepare for that a year or so out. Talk a little bit about what you're working on and the ways in which you're hoping to kind of get this ready.
Absolutely. So we are particularly interested in helping preserve significant sites along Route 66. And knowing that this is, you know, 2,400 miles for the whole route, we know we can't do everything. Yeah. We are focusing especially on sites that are associated with people of color, for example, indigenous peoples, Hispano, Black Americans, but also places associated with women, immigrants, LGBTQIA veterans, and also economically distressed communities.
So give us some examples. You've got grants coming in to sort of preserve things that you might not always think about, like a gas station or, you know, like a stop on the side of the road that used to be something kind of special, but nothing incredibly remarkable that now have fallen apart and you're trying to bring back to life.
Exactly. So I think a great example of that is the Osterman gas station, which is a 1929 filling station in Peach Springs, Arizona, that is owned by the Hualapai tribe. And this is a gas station that had been vacant for a number of years. And then there was a windstorm in 2021 that tore the roof off. It was a very intense microburst, and the tribe was trying to figure out what to do with it, and it stayed open to the elements. And so we ended up convening a coalition of different organizations within the state. We all got together to talk about how we could help this site, and ended up listing this site on the National Trust's 11 Most Endangered Places list in 2023. I will say that about a month before that listing was announced, another windstorm actually knocked another wall down. So wow, it was missing a wall and a roof. So honestly, it really would not have made it through another winter. And I'm happy to say that the finishing touches on the roof are going to be completed in the next month or two.
Wow. Okay. So why is a building like that, that, you know, was a gas station to begin with, like, why is that important? We even aired a conversation kind of about that gas station on the show here, about the question of sort of what deserves to be saved and what doesn't. Like, when are the costs worth it? Why is this worth it to you?
Right. And, you know, gas stations are kind of an interesting thing. But what is more iconic than, the place, if you're taking a road trip, those gas stations where you stop? So it's really something that I think speaks to just the auto travel nature of Route 66.
Are there ones that have slipped through the cracks that you wish you could bring back?
There are. I think, unfortunately, there's been, you know, all too much that has been lost. One that is not completely lost, but that is really in pretty dire condition in Arizona is the Twin Arrows site.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And they've lost one of those arrows, which has come down. That's a site that had one of the only original Valentine diners still in its original location. And it's still there, but it's had fires, it's had vandalism, it's had graffiti. We did a report on that, a conditions assessment report for that site 20 years ago, and it could have been brought back. And I was there maybe a year or two ago, and it was just heartbreaking to see the condition.
So by doing this, kind of taking a building here and there and preserving what you can, restoring what you can, what are your goals for, you know, what you hope will be celebrated in 2026?
We really want to find a way for Route 66 to enter its second century and to think about a really bright, vibrant future. Mm-hmm. And we know that that means not only making sure that pieces of the original Route 66, those historic elements, are still there and that you can still find those when you travel Route 66. But Route 66 is really much more than just old buildings. It is about those mom and pop businesses that are located along the route, whether they are businesses that have been there since Route 66 was officially commissioned. But it can also include businesses that have been started more recently that are really embracing that Route 66 vibe.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. Amy Webb, Senior Director of Preservation Programs at the National Trust for Historic Preservation. She leads the Preserve Route 66 initiative heading up to its centennial in 2026. Amy, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Maria Muldaur has been a fixture in American music for over 50 years. She is perhaps most widely known for the song Midnight at the Oasis, which has been a hit basically since the day it was released in 1974. But even before that song made her famous, Muldaur was a fixture in the burgeoning 1960s folk scene in Greenwich Village. There's even a character based on Muldaur in the upcoming Timothy Chalamet Bob Dylan biopic. Muldaur is currently on tour with a show called Way Past Midnight, which comes to Phoenix tonight, and I spoke with her about it recently. I hope you don't mind me saying this. I was so charmed when our producer Ayana told me that she was in touch with you directly to coordinate the bookings over email, and I thought, you know, that's so rare for an artist of your stature to be so engaged. What do you like about doing that?
I'm just happy to hear from people that are interested in my music.
Well, I'd have to say, you know, as somebody who is in the very fortunate position of communicating with folks like yourself a lot, there was just something very authentic about it. And It was
very... Well, that's the kind of music I try to do. I try to play authentic American roots music, and maybe it just is part of who I am.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, do you remember when you realized that you loved to sing?
Of course. I was about 5 years old, and I was a little Italian-American gal growing up in Greenwich Village. And my mother's younger sister loved what she called cowboy music, which was Hank Williams, Kitty Wells, Hank Snow, a lot of people named Hank, you know, Ernest Tubb, people like that. And I remember at age five, this is my earliest memory of singing, my Aunt Katie playing sort of very fractured honky-tonk piano and me singing, "It Wasn't God Who Made Honky-Tonk Angels," with all my little heart and soul.
Wow. Did there ever come a time when somebody said, like, "Maria, I think you've really got something here"?
Well, there was all around me in Greenwich Village the emergence of a folk music scene. A lot of people in the urban north were checking out music from the mostly from the rural south, you know, bluegrass, blues, old-timey music. Mm-hmm. And I started learning some songs and playing, and I learned a song from the B-side of Peggy Lee called "I'm a Woman." And I took out my little nylon string guitar, and I started plunking around with the three chords I knew, and I put this funky little R&B groove to it. Mm-hmm. And I started learning the song and singing it at parties, and people seemed to like it, and that encouraged me. In fact, a young gentleman named Bob Dylan, who had just sort of landed on the scene, liked that song. And whenever we'd be at a little gathering, he'd say, "Hey, Maria, play that I'm a Woman song." So I think, you know, back around that time, I started playing and people just encouraged it. And, you know, coming out of the 50s, what was on pop radio had become pretty insipid and vapid.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I can imagine being in Greenwich Village and being around all these folks who were part of a musical revolution, that probably informed wanting to step outside the mainstream sound that was coming out of the radio.
Yes. I was so blessed to be right at the epicenter of a scene in which I got to meet people like Doc Watts and Mississippi John Hurt, a lot of the early pioneers of what we call Americana music today.
Yeah. When you meet somebody like Doc Watson or Mississippi John Hurt, I mean, these are mythic names. How does meeting somebody like that, whose music you've been playing, how does it impact the way that you think about a song by one of those folks?
Doc Watson's father-in-law invited me down to North Carolina after a concert because I just kind of fell in love with the very simple, sweet way he played the fiddle.
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, why don't you come down to Deep Gap, North Carolina, and I'll teach you everything I know." So I had the opportunity to do that. I went down there with my boyfriend, and we stayed at Doc Watson's house, and that was a whole experience in itself for a little Italian gal from New York City who had never been past New Jersey.
Sure.
To suddenly find myself in the Appalachian Mountains experiencing a lifestyle that was just something almost out of another century. You know, his relatives would come on down after supper and sit on the porch, and they'd all sing these amazing Appalachian hymns and songs and play fiddle tunes. So I just sort of absorbed and osmosed the whole experience, and it changed me forever.
Yeah. One of the things that I find really remarkable about your career is you have released so much music under your own name, but you have also done so much work to reinterpret the music of other artists like Peggy Lee, like Blue Lou Barker. And I'm curious how you approach the challenge of connecting with the music of another artist, but putting your own stamp on it.
I think, you know, being that I don't write songs, mm-hmm. I did happen to develop the knack of knowing what a good song is and who the good songwriters in this country are. I also have done a bunch of albums paying tribute to my musical heroes. People like Memphis Minnie, who was a phenomenal blues singer who also, she was came out of 20s and 30s and right around the Memphis area. And not only sang the blues, but she wrote and recorded over 200 of her own songs and played absolutely bitchin' guitar.
Mm-hmm.
The one I want to do now, my bucket list, is to do one on Victoria Spivey, who was a contemporary of Minnie. And as far as I know, was the first artist savvy enough to have her own record label. And she spotted me in Washington Square Park playing the fiddle and singing, and took me under her wing, took me to her apartment, and she'd play me these old 78s of different blues women. She thought she was trying to find songs that would be suitable to my young voice. And she would give me pointers. She'd say, "Now, I want you to listen to me." She said, "You get up there, it ain't enough to sound good. You got to look good, too." She said, "You got to get up there and strut your stuff and make all eyes be on you." And then she looked me straight in the eye and said, "That's what they call stage presence." And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And I took her advice to heart. And so when I think about it now, you asked the question at the very beginning of the interview about, you know, was there anyone that said, "You've really got it"? And actually, that's what Victoria Spivey was saying, that you've really got something. She spotted it when it was in its most, you know, green and beginning form.
Well, Maria Muldaur will be at the Musical Instrument Museum tonight, playing music, singing songs, and telling stories like the ones you heard her tell today. Maria, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Sam.
Midnight at the Oasis. Send your camel to bed.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.